Tracy Chapman and B.B. King with The Thrill Is Gone, one of King's signature songs. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Monday, December the 30th. And Hillary Clinton, according to a Gallup poll on most admired women, topped the list ahead of Oprah Winfrey, First Lady Michelle Obama, and former presidential candidate Sarah Palin. This is the 18th time that Clinton was voted as most admired, although the first time that she is not in an official or governmental role. And President Obama is the most admired man, the Gallup poll says, ahead of George Bush and Pope Francis. It's unusual that Obama polled first. It's not unusual, that Obama polled first on the list, says Gallup, since presidents have topped the most admired list for the past 33 years. Well, that's nice news. That's good to know. Except today we'll be talking about the thrill being about 62.5% gone. It's the first year of his second term, just about completed. We only have one day to go. It is no secret that the various constituencies that delivered for President Obama twice are less than satisfied with the yield on their political investment. What used to be hushed rumbling now has become sharp, open criticism as historically marginalized groups see their standard bearer either unable or unwilling to engage fully in the battle he had promised to wage in their behalf. There's a palpable sense that he has gone to the other side, that is, to the business as usual politics, doing what is expedient rather than what is necessary. So today, we'll take a look, we'll assess where things are, especially given the fact that we have only three more years to go in this administration. The question being asked today is, what's the agenda, his and ours, for the next 3 years? Here is candidate Barack Obama making his last campaign speech in 2012 in Des Moines, Iowa, where his campaign for his first term in 2008 began. He came back, he said, to a crowd of about 20,000 people. He came back seeking their help to finish what we started. Let's listen to candidate Obama battling for re-election in 2012.
But to wage that fight on behalf of American families, I need you to still have some fight in you, too. You know, the folks at the top of this country, turns out they don't need another champion in Washington. They'll always have a seat at the table. They'll always have access and influence. The people who need a champion are the Americans whose letters I read late at night after a long day in the office. The men and women I meet on the campaign trail every day. The laid-off furniture worker who's retraining at the age of 55 for a new career at a community college. She needs a champion. The restaurant owner who needs a loan to expand. He's got great food, but the bank turned him down. He needs help. He needs a champion. The cooks and the waiters and cleaning staff working overtime in a hotel in Des Moines or Vegas, trying to save enough to buy a first home or send their kid to college. They need a champion. The auto worker who was laid off, thought the plant would never reopen, and is now back on the job, filled with pride and dignity, building a great car, building America. He needs a champion. The teacher in an overcrowded classroom with outdated school books, digging into her own pocket, to buy school supplies. Not always feeling like she's got the support she needs, but showing up every day because she knows that this might be the day that she's got a breakthrough and she makes a difference in one child's life. She needs a champion. All those kids in inner cities, small farm towns, kids dreaming of becoming scientists or doctors, engineers or entrepreneurs, diplomats, or even a president, they need a champion in Washington. Because the future will never have as many lobbyists as the status quo. Children don't have lobbyists the way oil companies or banks do, but it's the dreams of those children that will be our saving grace. That's what we fight for. That's why I need you, Iowa, to make sure their voices are heard, to make sure your voices are heard. And that's why we've come too far to turn back now. We've come too far to let our hearts grow faint. Now's the time to keep pushing forward, to educate all our kids and train all our workers and to create new jobs and rebuild our roads and bring back our troops and care for our veterans and broaden opportunity and grow our middle class and restore our democracy and make sure that no matter who you are or where you come from or how you started out, what you look like, who you love, what your last name is, here in America you can make it if you try. That's what we're fighting for. And Iowa, after all the months of campaigning, after all the rallies, after the millions of dollars of ads, it all comes down to you. It's out of my hands now. It's in yours. All of it depends on what you do. When you step into that voting booth tomorrow, it's just a remarkable thing, the way our democracy works. And at a certain point, all this effort and all these campaign rallies, and then it just comes down to each of us as citizens. All of it depends on you bringing your friend or your neighbor, your coworker, your mom, your dad, your wife, your husband to the polls. That's how our democracy is supposed to be. The single most powerful force in our democracy is you. Moving this country forward begins with you.
Well, that sounded very convincing. The arguments are very clear. That it's clear that he understood them. He made the point of appealing to people and saying what he was prepared to do. And all he needed was for people to get on board and for people to recognize that they could find in him a champion, which is really what it boils down to be, what politics is all about. The idea that you make an investment, which is your vote, you contribute to campaigns, perhaps even on top of your vote, and you get a champion. You get a champion because at some point you see yourself as being a member of one particular group or another, or constituency or another, and you identify with a candidate based on professed commitments, shared commitments, that if legitimized and energized with the vote, all these things that were enumerated there by the president on that night, on the eve of the election in 2012 in Des Moines, Iowa, talked about jobs and education and all these these are not lofty things. These are basics, the very basic things in a society. I talked quite frequently in the last couple of months about the way we measure a society is not about how often you vote or how often the society has elections and all of that. You measure it by the quality and the degree of access that people have, regular people who participate in the democratic process, the degree to which they have access to the strategic resources of the society that they're living in. And I say you don't have to worry about 400 of those resources. Just concentrate on five. Five, and you have a good picture of what kind of a society you're living in and whether your expectations are in line with what is professed as the contract a candidate says he or she has with the constituents who put them in office. We talked about these are basics, very basic things. Food security. We talked about shelter or housing, employment, education, healthcare, and security, meaning safety. Well, what do we see in each of these categories? Not a very pretty picture. It is incomprehensible. The president spent $684 million on his campaign. $684 million. And for the second, just for permission to go back into office, to get the job done, to continue fighting the fight and just getting this job done, I'm just concentrating on five areas. Tell me today, does the overwhelming vote that he got, it was down a little from his first run, which indicated a certain disaffection, but nothing major. The president's support base remained relatively steady. This is after all that hullabaloo of the first term. We were clear what was going on there from the beginning. We anticipated that the president was going to get a tremendous amount of resistance in Congress from Republicans, and he did, but he also asked for it. What had happened to the president, and it's becoming clearer and clearer, is that in the beginning, this was a candidacy that was in large measure experimental, and in large measure also bewilderingly successful. Experimental in the sense that given the racist pillars on which U.S. society is resting, it is very unlikely, especially at that time, for an African-American, put it that way, an African-American or a biracial person, such as Barack Obama, to come to win the big prize, which is the presidency of the United States. That came about as a result of incredible amounts of work. Now, people would, say, well, this is because we had brilliant advisors and so forth, and there's no denying that. But at the same time, this president's candidacy served as a huge experiment in political science. The generation of knowledge, specialized knowledge in running political campaigns based on entirely new political formulae. This was not run-of-the-mill. This was a high-tech game. This was a very, very, a very methodical approach. But while certain people were doing the thinking, the vast majority of people surrounding Barack Obama, that is his base, were the ones doing the working. They were doing the heavy lifting. They were getting things done. And I might add, for free. They didn't charge. Now, all of that science that was pioneered during his first run is now the private intellectual property of a few. And that has spawned an entirely new version of political consulting, which is where those folks went off. They went off the reservation, as it were. Because inevitably it became clear that this was a great thing. They've perfected the science and they're now the owners of the science. Barack Obama does not continue to benefit from their scientific approach, say, to lobbying to get the job done. They've gone. They're making millions of dollars now in taking on major contracts from any and anybody with a lot of money who wants to run. They've set up, in fact, a spin-off of Obama's campaign is now officially a separate business. It's cloaked now under the 501c3 or c4 tax code as a nonprofit, but make no mistake about it. This is the spawn of a whole new kind of employment, and it is extremely white. When we are asked, the president is asking people to come on and finish their job. Continue to lift, continue to be out there, run out in the streets, do all these things to get me up and running. But you won't be paid, which is the first thing. It's not that people do these things for pay. It is just the way things happen. And you have to look at how even a campaign, there's no loyalty to Barack Obama. Loyalty to Barack Obama depends on how much he can pay. And this entire system, this intricate system, this brand new system that was launched with his first campaign is now a science, and no black person owns any part of that. The knowledge rests in a very tight circle. And they already have commodified it. They're making very big money being the specialists at this nationwide. That's the first group who have pimped off of the Obama administration and the Obama phenomenon. Secondly, the people who surrounded Obama and who he chose, they didn't invade his office and say, here I am, you must hire me. He selected people. The vast majority of whom were ambitious and who used this platform. I'm trying to demonstrate here how people need to reconstruct their thinking about politics, because this is a consistent pattern. The people who basically expend the energy of an intricate part of an economic machine from which they derive absolutely nothing. Obama, therefore, is in his first term, they stick around long enough for them to make contacts and to get the lay of the land and to figure out how they could make money, and they then departed. Because, like, say, Rahm Emanuel, who was his chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel said, okay, now that we are here, now that he is in the White House, now's my time. I'm breaking free of this, and I will capitalize on this. Obama owes me. So he's gone to Chicago, and he becomes mayor. Based on the black vote generated for Barack Obama. You see how it goes? Hillary Clinton says, ha, well, first of all, she just, basically, somebody must have walked into Obama and said, here's your Secretary of State, and he just said, okay. But everybody knew that she was very miffed at not being president, so she might as well be the third in line behind the vice president. You can't do very much as vice president. The job of a vice president largely is to remain invisible. Say nothing, be seldom seen, and even more seldom heard. So she went for Secretary of State, and she got it. Why? Because she saw the long haul. She was going to move on to someday be president. She was practically president as Secretary of State. She was certainly co-president under with the Bill Clinton administration. She was co-president of the United States. She was given the gift. She never said, well, I'm a feminist through and through, and I will earn my keep. I will earn my kudos the old-fashioned way by merit. Merit my eye. She said, look, I put up with this buzzard for the past X number of years. He's embarrassed me. I want to be in politics because eventually I could be as good as, or if not better, president than he is. So give me a Senate seat. That's where I'll start my political career. They made it possible. She waltzed into the U.S. Senate and then said, okay, time for the big job. The same people, this new constituency revitalized by Obama's first run, are going to be used to launch Mrs. Clinton into office. We see in New York City, where Bill de Blasio, the new mayor of the city, who was an aide to Bill Clinton, is going to have Bill Clinton preside at his inauguration. We get it. You see how it all works. But at the bottom of it all are these distressed people, blacks and Latinos especially, Native Americans are just absolutely crushed into dust. If blacks and Latinos think they have it bad, they are crushed into fine dust on any level of measurement. And the game of politics goes on. The people surrounding Barack Obama saw, who would never, by the way, and let me insist on this, who themselves, by themselves, would never have a prayer to land wherever they ended up landing, whether as a director of the Treasury, the schools, I talk about the Secretary of Education, and these jobs, they would never be in such positions. They're not qualified for them at all. But it is this engine that has expended this much energy to make these people very confident in predicating their launch in all these other areas that are money making. I mean, they're making tons of money. And in the meantime, who are the experts at guiding the lead guy through the maze of opposition in the Senate and in the House? They're not there. Obama clearly was outclassed with respect to experience in dealing at this level. The people who said, yeah, we'll get you up and going, they got him up and running, and they took off. They're not in for the long haul. There's no merit to being in the long haul because you're stuck doing the same thing for the same $174,000 a year. Why would you settle for $174,000 when you could be making a couple of million dollars a year? So, big deal, Obama wins, and he is left to fight. He can't come out and say that he was abandoned. He can't admit to that, but in fact, he was abandoned. He his stars took off. And then other people who were genuine, who came in to work genuinely, saw that there was a heck of a lot of difference between what was articulated as promises and the capacity to deliver. Obama was weak. He didn't have the guts to fight. And he couldn't call on anybody because by then these people had isolated him and he himself agreed to be isolated. He's not talking to people. He's not talking to blacks. He's not talking to Latinos. He's not talking to the people who formed the engine that could back him up. And he's not calling for their help either. He's too embarrassed. He'd been had in his first term. He was used up by these gutter snipe politicians posing as policymakers. They left him there to, you figure it out. We already have what we want. We're done. You just go out there. Now raise money for the Democratic Party because you know Mrs. Clinton, if she's running, she's got to have money. You go out there and do all of this. So all of this president's focus was not on fulfilling this contract that he said that he was going to be the champion of. He couldn't champion anything. You just talk. You're just talking. Like James Brown said, you're talking loud and saying nothing. Everybody knows the secret. With all that talk, you do not have a methodology of winning in Congress and in the U.S. Senate. You just don't. So, you have nobody to call on because you have decided you don't need them anymore. He was thinking just like them. They'll get me into the White House. I don't need them after that. Which is what explains, you could wait for 790 days before you talk to the Black Congressional Caucus. Right? That's the strategy here. This president got mauled by his own people. He got sucker punched. He can't admit it. He can't say it publicly. But that is not only as much as, I think that is a greater reason than the opposition from racist folks in Congress who just cannot allow, they will certainly not allow this president to succeed at anything. And he does not have the wherewithal to function in a way where he inspires confidence and where his people are going to stay with him, where he selects the right people for the right job. Most of the jobs of that President Obama has assigned to other people, these are all patronage jobs. He's not bringing in people who can create change. Are you kidding me? Change? Who wants change? I have a bunch of things I have to do before I clear out of here. I have to pay back these people for, you know, the multi-billions of dollars that they put into my campaign. I had to set myself up, just like Bill Clinton, for an afterlife where I'd be making far more money than I ever made in my entire life. Just showing up, Bill Clinton gets $150,000 a speech. They've never made this much money. He's never made this much money as governor of Arkansas or congressman from Arkansas. He'd never made any of that kind of money at all. These are basic average. Don't forget, Bill Clinton does not come from money. Neither does, Hillary comes from a little bit, tiny little bit. But essentially, these are not extraordinary people. They're not members of any political elite. These are just, in the world of politics, which is white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, these folks are way low down on the ladder, socially, politically, and otherwise. Bill Clinton is not viewed as a man of great character by the blue bloods who traditionally have run this country. And you don't want to know what they think about Hillary Clinton. But it is the black vote. The black vote. And Jimmy Carter said this himself. He said it about himself. If it weren't for the black vote, he would never have had a political life. Same for Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton. Black folks have just loved everybody who would do really great harm to them. They go and love them. The more ridiculous the things are, the harder they love. And this president was acting exactly that way. He had no use for anybody because he's smart. He's a smart guy. And they took this smart guy and delivered him exactly where he said he wanted to be. And now if he needs them, he's going to have to pay them. And they will use the same information, they will use the same technology, they will use the same knowledge that they acquired for free working on his campaign. This president, for the next 3 years, is not going to go much farther in terms of delivering for anybody. I just don't see it. He's, in fact, going to, at some point, and unless he is really, really steamed off, unless he really gets righteously angry at how he was played and still is being played, unless he really internalizes that and says, I'm going for broke, I've got nothing to lose, I'm going for broke right now, and he begins to operate on that level, I just don't see it changing. But for him to do that, he's got to have guts. He doesn't. He's got to be confident in the relationship he has with his political base. He has no confidence in his political base because he knows how he has treated them. This is the quintessential difference between a leader like Obama and a leader like another one that came out of Chicago, which is Harold Washington. When all those unions said, well, we're going to strike and bring the city to its knees, Harold Washington said, come on, bring it on, let's go. You think you're going to intimidate me to think that you're going to shut the city down? You just do that. Because he knew that the swelling support that he had among his constituents, he could outlive any threat. He could outlast any hardship because he had an extraordinary organic link with his people. You don't see that every day. Barack Obama can't do that. He could have done that in his first term right at the start because people were latched onto him. They shared his hopes and dreams and aspirations. They were ready to lift him up. They were ready to surround him and defend him and to defend the standards that he was going to go in there with. They were ready to help him fight. They were ready to endorse everything that he put forward to benefit everybody. But that was not his aim and objective. We have to admit, sadly, he doesn't have the guts. Nor does he have the faith in his constituencies. It is quite the other way around. His constituencies have greater faith in him than he does in them. In which case, he's not a desirable leader. It's like Mahatma Gandhi once said that of leaders say, there go my people, I must hurry to catch up with them. That's where he is. And because that's where he is, that is where we are. Now, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? There are 3 years left. What are we prepared to do? I'm asking you the question. I'm waiting for your answers at 888-874-4888 right after this brief message. This is Lee Stories. You're listening to You Trace Lead. It is December the 30th, and I'm asking the question, what are you prepared to do for the next 3 years? What is President Obama's and our agenda for the next 3 years? Waiting for your thoughts at 888-874-4888. We will know how serious this president is when we see in him, come the 1st of January, a dramatic departure from what has become, very sadly, his norm. If he maintains the norm, we're cooked. We might as well just get away from that and do something completely different. Hello, you're on the air, Sarah.
Greetings to you, Utrice.
Thank you.
Greetings to the PRN audience. Utrice, as I stated in several conversations with you, right now at this point in time, we are caught between a rock and a very hard place as a people, because you cannot negotiate right now. Once the contract is signed and it's in, and you started working on that contract, it is very useless to go back in and try to amend it, because all of that should have been done prior to you accepting the taking the offer and going ahead and starting on this contract. We as a people, we had negotiating rights before November of 2012. As it stands right now, this administration for the president is going to be a fruitless remaining 3 years.
It doesn't have to be. If, for example, the unions get really ruthless, if communities get really ruthless and press the point, if the Democratic Party is shaping up to lose more than it bargained for, I think there would be a change of heart.
Yes, it would be a change of heart. On the local level, as I've always said, politics is local. You have more control on a local level because things you are more affected locally by things that like your mayors, your police chiefs, your district attorneys, judges, those things have more of a daily impact on you than what goes on the national level. And that
That include congressional seats and U.S. Senate? I mean, that is also a very, very serious place of impact. These are two serious places of impact, in the Congress and in the Senate.
Yes, Utrice, it is. But when we look at it on like this, we only have two senators per state, which is very broad, as well as your congressional representative, because right now I'm in the 30th district represented by Edie Bernice Johnson, and that's another story for another time and place to talk about that. But our locality, we have more control on a local level. And as you said, with the Democratic Party, everybody who is black and have put all of your eggs in this Democratic basket, you need to remove them from out of those baskets, because, as you said, you have one party that you give over 90% of your vote to, and they completely take you for granted, and you have the other party out here, the Republicans, who don't even want to be bothered with you because they already know that they really and truly don't need you. You're just excess, and, you know, maybe they'll get to you whenever they get to you. So right now we are treated with disrespect by both parties. And even the so-called progressive and the liberals, all of these tags and names that these people want to come up with and want to say, okay, you need to come over here and join with us and, you know, the Green Party and all these other names, these are all rejects that came out of these two other parties. They all have the same mindset as the Democrats, whereby with black people, you have to be in a subordinate position where somebody white is in charge of these parties, because we already saw what happened with us with the Communist Party and all these other Marxist agenda that we had before. where they have to be our spokesperson for us, and they have to speak on our behalf. We don't have any access or any input in what it is that affects us. It's all this, you know, oh, we're going to do this. But each people, it affects them differently. We are always at the worst end of these deals when it comes to political agenda. Our situation is not the same as a Latino or an Asian or an Arab person. It is very different.
So what is your recommendation for the next 3 years?
The next 3 years, Utrecht, as you said, is non-participation in the democratic function. Push the people already who are in there, who are getting ready to run for election. Go to these town hall meetings whenever they come back to the district and they want to have it. You need to go there. You need to make your voices heard. You need to let them know how dissatisfied because you treat.
But quickly, we have a bunch of people I want to get on, too.
Let them know because you treat technically right now. We have lost the race because it's controlled by money. These congressional representatives or whatever, they are controlled by other businesses who fund their campaign and not you who they come looking to get votes. That is why they ignore us and they disrespect us.
We will leave it there. Thank you so much,
ma'am,
for getting the conversation started today. Jill from Florida, what is your view? Hello, Jill? Jill is not there? Okay. DX from L.A.
Hello, Utrecht. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you. I hope you're saying.
I'm doing fine, thanks. I will make my comments brief. I kind of disagree with Sarah. I think what we have to do, all due respect to Sarah, but I think what we have to do is just don't mess with these people at all. I mean, I just think that the whole system is so corrupt that we need to just stay on a local level, grassroots, and try to do things that way. All resistance is local, to quote Chris Hedges. I mean, but how many times are we going to let them do this? Now you got people all over the world and in this country running for office using the Obama model, meaning they run as one thing. Then when they get in there, they do something completely opposite of that. So, you know, how many times are we going to let them put, let's say, excrement on a plate and call it chocolate ice cream? You know what I mean? I mean, we need to stop this. Just let their system crash and burn. Just leave it alone. Don't participate in their politics, their phony politics at all. And that's my view.
But if you don't participate, let's say, what do you then use as leverage? In any event, whether you participate or not, they're going to be making, quote, policies, unquote, that will affect all of us.
Right. Well, I believe that, like I said, all resistance has to be local. You run for what affects you in your town or city or whatever, to whatever level you can really affect things, because we have no effect anyway. We vote for one thing, and we want one thing to happen, and they do most of the time the exact opposite, or they do little piecemeal little, you know, trinkets of things or whatever that don't really help us. So we're not getting anywhere anyway. And what I think is eventually, if they keep going the way they're going with this corporate control of government, it's just going to crash and burn. So I think the fewer of us they have participating in their system, the better. And I'm not talking any particular race or anything. I'm talking about the whole body of American, the American people, citizens. Just don't. We need to not participate in their phony stuff.
Okay. Well, thank you, DX.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Thanks so much. This is a question today, folks. We've already witnessed 5 years. We can reasonably come to certain conclusions about the 5 years that we've witnessed. What, therefore, having witnessed these 5 years, and therefore in a position to kind of prognosticate as to what we think would happen in the other three, what, therefore, do we do about the other 3 years? What do we do for those other 3 years? What is it? What is the agenda? What is the agenda for President Obama, if any? What is the agenda for us, the people being governed by this government. What do we do for the next 3 years? What are the priorities? One way or the other, the years are going to come. And with them, all kinds of shady dealings from Congress, even shadier than the ones we see. What is the answer? 888-874-4888. This is where we stuck. This is where we are. We have no way of knowing from this president what his intentions are and what is going to be done about all of these agenda items that you just heard him talk about, you know, in 2012, on the cusp of his second term in office. All these things he said very clearly. These are the things that he was going to be a champion of. How come they're just not measuring up? All these things that you're championing, we don't see that very much is being done. For example, about jobs, about the economy, and about the groups that continue, despite all, you know, attestations to the opposite. We have the groups at the bottom rung of the ladder consistent throughout history, consistently at the bottom. What does that tell us about our society? That whether it is a Republican president or a Democratic president, whether they profess to be conservative or middle of the road or right of center or even, quote, liberal, unquote, why is it that we are constantly seeing the same result? Then something must be wrong. What is wrong? What could possibly be wrong? And how do we fix it? Here's a chance. We still have 3 years. What are we prepared to do with the next 3 years to set this boat right? Because I think we will have to make a stand. We will have to let it be known that there is an awakening. How do we communicate that message? That this constituency, whether it is gays or whether it is veterans or whether blacks, Latinos, Asians, whoever, the way politics is played here in the United States with all these disparate groups fighting for their unique rights. How do we conduct the next 3 years politically? If you were a political advisor right now, what would you say are the top priority items for the next 3 years? You've got to have an idea. I want to know and share it with us. 888-874-4888. Just as I'm waiting for calls, I'll let you know that on tomorrow, of course, we broadcast regularly, but on New Year's Day, we're not. We come back on the 2nd. Tom from L.A., you're on the air.
Hi, Eutrice.
Hello.
Hi. My concern for the next 3 years, and I believe in the next 3 months, our biggest challenge right now are the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic Partnership. Everyone must call their congressmen and tell them they will vote them out of office if they vote for these PACs. Right now, these PACs are the biggest threat to us getting anything done in the next 3 years. If they are signed, all of our freedoms will be taken away. We will not have the Constitution we have now. We will not have any environmental laws. We will not have the right to sue. This is our biggest threat. Obama is a corporate shill. He will never change. He was picked by the Bilderbergs to get into office. Same with the Clintons. We need to pick candidates like Jill Stein, Rocky Anderson, and Jesse Ventura, and I believe that they need to all come together, and we need to start a grassroots campaign starting now, planning for 2016, the election, to get one of them in. And people need to be made aware. People are not aware. They're either going to watch Fox News or they watch MSNBC, and the tenor of the debate is not even where we want it to be. It's about the Republicans are at fault. It's about the Democrats are at fault. Meanwhile, corporations are pulling all of the strings, and they're masterminding this whole entire plan to gain complete control of the world, to get complete control of all governments. That's what's really going on here. And Obama's just a player in the game.
What's going to happen in the midterm elections in 2014?
Well, you know, I don't think much is going to happen either way. I don't think much is going to happen. Republicans will do their best to change the tenor of the debate. They will show with good cause that the economy is going nowhere, that we're not creating jobs. Of course, they'll sell the same old platform, trickle-down economics, which doesn't work and doesn't create jobs. And then on the Democratic side, they'll show with basically that the corporates, the Republicans, are obstructionists. So not much is going to happen either way. Really, and nothing's really going to get done if we keep the same people in office. Look at what Obama wants to do. He wants to fast-track the transatlantic and the trans-Pacific pact so that Congress doesn't even have time to read it. So that shows you the definition of Barack Obama. He's a corporatist. And the same with a lot of Democrats. That's why they can't be trusted. And they're part of a bigger system of corporations that just want to gain control of the world. And that's who the real challenge is that we have. And the people in office are picked by those corporations.
All right. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Thanks for your input today. This from another Tom, Smith, responding on leadstories@gmail.com, saying, "Dear Utrice, while I certainly sympathize with both your and Sarah's anti-Democratic Party, anti-Obama political stances, and also Sarah's awareness of the manipulative nature of the Stalinist Communist Party, I feel compelled to assert that the Trotskyist Socialist Workers' Party in the 1940s had a membership that was half black. Despite the confusion created by Trotsky's and C.L.R. James's own adaptation to black nationalism, later culminating in the abstentionism of George Brightman, this racial integration was the residue of the revolutionary integrationist position of John Reed in the early Communist Party, Jim Cannon, founder of the Socialist Workers' Party, and Max Schachtman, later culminating in the position of Richard Fraser." I am completely confused by that paragraph. "This is a position which refuses to adapt to black nationalism, yet which aims to put the special demands of black people in America first on the plate, first on the program. This is a model for political organizing in the United States today. It is a viable alternative to capitulation to Democrats." Well, I understand some of that, I really do, but much of it I also don't understand, especially that paragraph there. It got a little jangled. Here's another from Livia. She says, "Great show today." No, this is reading the wrong thing. Where am I going now? She said, "Oh, I'm out of time. I didn't know that. Thank you for this." Thank you so much for today. I just got the cue, musical cue, that we're out of here. Up next is Richard Martin with Wake Up Call. Stay tuned. We'll be back with each other tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Thanks for listening.